Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Terry Gunn, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tackling tailwaters. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Terry Gunn about tackling tailwaters. At flyfishtv.com, you can find Terry and Wendy Gunn's two classic beginning to fish videos. Introduction to Fly Fishing and Introduction to Fly Casting are a great way to get a friend or family member into the sport. Top sellers for over 10 years, the videos take the mystique out of fly fishing and gently introduce the craft and basic skills to the uninitiated. Terry and Wendy's Introduction to Fly Fishing and Introduction to Fly Casting DVDs and streamed videos are available at flyfishtv.com along with other great instructional fly fishing videos. Visit flyfishtv.com today and see all the great DVDs they have to offer. Well, before we introduce Terry, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Terry's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving a DVD away from Flyfish TV, and we're going to let you have your choice. You can choose Terry and Wendy Gunn's two classic videos that we just talked about in our commercial break and or any other DVD of your choice at Flyfish TV. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we will talk about during the show. It'll be something we talk about during the show, and maybe a one-two-part question. I kind of leave that at my discretion. But at the end of the show, I'm going to ask those questions, and the first person to type in the correct answer will win the DVD. Now, you need to do that in the text box on our homepage and the same place that you can ask questions at during the show. So use that text box to submit your answer at the end of the show and see if you don't win. Our guest tonight is Terry Gunn. Terry is co-owner and founder of Lee's Ferry Anglers Fly Shop and Guide Service and Cliff Dwellers Lodge in Marble Canyon, Arizona. Terry has been a full-time fly fishing guide since 1983 and is an internationally recognized fly fishing expert, author, photographer, and speaker. Terry has fished around the world in both fresh and salt water, and in 1986, he co-founded Crystal Creek Lodge, considered by many to be one of Alaska's finest fly-out fishing lodges. He also started Baja Anglers, a fly fishing charter boat operation and retail store in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. He is also a consultant to several leading manufacturers of fly fishing equipment and fishing lodges. He also held or holds 10 IGFA world records, all on fly rod, both fresh and salt water. Terry's wildlife and fly fishing photographs have appeared in most all of the outdoor magazines, as well as books, journals, newspapers, calendars, and brochures. He's a recognized author and has published many technical as well as destination fly fishing articles for several magazines. He and his wife, Wendy, have recently compiled and published the book, The 50 Best Tailwaters to Fly Fish. Terry and Wendy are co-hosts of Fly Fish Television Magazine, an educational fly fishing show that has aired on Fox Sports National and International, the Outdoor Channel. They also have two videos, an introduction to fly fishing and an introduction to fly casting. Terry was the photography host for the television series American Outdoor Journal, and in addition, he has appeared on scores of other fly fishing shows, including In Search of Fly Waters, Fly Fishing the World, Fly Fishing America, and Fly Fishing Video Magazine. Terry and his wife, Wendy, competed in the first ESPN Great Outdoor Games in Lake Placid, New York. Well, Terry, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. Great honor to be here.
Well, great to have you. We had your better half quite a while ago. And Wendy did a great job educating us on Lee's Ferry and the tailwater there. Tonight, I wanted to focus more, because of your book that you recently published, wanted to focus more in general about tailwaters. We do, I know some folks sent in some questions about Lee's Ferry, and we'll leave those till the end, and we will answer those specifically about Lee's Ferry. But, you know, with a book visiting 50 tailwaters, I would think that'd give you a pretty broad brush to paint a picture of what tailwater fishing is like in the U.S. So let's dive right in here, and let's start out with, you know, I think there's a lot of different ideas about what a tailwater is, but what is a tailwater to you?
Roger, tailwaters are found in about every corner of North America. They provide cold, clear water year-round and support populations of rainbows, browns, cutthroats, bull trout, kokanee, and multiple other game fish. Some of the most iconic waters in the United States are tailwaters. The Beaverhead, Bighorn, Deschutes, Frying Pan, Henry's Fork, Madison, Missouri, Snake, just to mention a few. I think the best example of what a tailwater is in our foreword of our book, which was written by Lefty Cray. And I'm just going to read that to you real quick. Lefty said, "Tailwaters are the salvation of fly fishing for trout. These are streams or rivers exiting from dams with a flow dependent on the amount of water released. They furnish a constant supply of clear, cold water necessary for trout and their food. Many trout anglers believe all major rivers are located in the west, but some of the finest tailwaters are in the east, created years ago when the Tennessee Valley Authority dammed many southern rivers to furnish the region's electric power. Some of these tailwaters are among the best trout rivers anywhere in this country and within easy driving distance of thousands of anglers. As our country's population grows, many streams and rivers will be depleted to furnish the life-giving water. Combined with this will be more development and increased demand for growing more food. All of this will stress our free-flowing rivers, reducing their size, polluting them, and elevating temperatures to levels unhealthy for trout. Because impoundments hold vital drinking water, they will survive, their outlets producing tailwaters benefiting trout. More and more fly fishers will have to depend on tailwater fisheries for their sport. Tailwaters often produce special hatches and frequently desirable increased aquatic vegetation. Water temperatures within a reasonable distance below a dam's outlet will be constant and cold throughout the season. Nearby waters may be covered with ice and snow, but tailwaters will be flowing, and the trout will be feeding on insects thriving in such an environment. In short, tailwaters furnish 12 months of good fly rotting."
Lefty ought to know, huh?
Lefty, if anyone should know, absolutely.
Yeah, that's probably, well, it's a lot of things there that we'll be talking about more detail tonight that he addressed there. Yeah, it makes me kind of think, I've just started to really dig into more history here in Colorado, and, you know, we did a show on the greenback trout last year or the year before, I can't remember when, but it's kind of interesting to dig into the history of our states before these dams were built and understand what the water was back then and what the trout situation was, and it was much different, and that the tailwater kind of, you know, I mean, it created trophy trout water that really didn't exist in the early days of the West. And I thought that was, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think back in the early days of Colorado, at least, there was a lot of the trout streams held pretty much, they held a lot more fish, but a lot smaller fish. And that was just due to the, you know, the type of streams that were there, more freestone streams and so forth. So, yeah, this tailwater thing has created a whole new playground for us as fly fishers.
No doubt about it, and it's pretty interesting. If you look in many states, if you were to look at the state record rainbow, brown, and brook trout, they are all going to come from tailwaters, and that's very common. Now, something real important to mention here, too, there is a double-edged sword because, you know, tailwaters are wonderful for fishing and storage of water, but, you know, they've also, some of the native fish have been extirpated, and, you know, areas have been flooded. So, you know, there's give and take. However, you know, the people that built these dams, a lot of them were designed a long time ago, and to second guess them now is a very complicated dilemma.
Well, I know down, especially in your area, there is, and I know this exists in, up there on the Green River, going through Dinosaur and so forth. You know, those endangered species and chubs and what is it, the other one, Razorback, or I know there's...
Razorback chub, humpback chub, Colorado River squawfish are some of the endangered fish that we have here in the West. And, of course, you know, in the South, there are other concerns as well.
Right. But there's been a lot of work done on that, including just before the show we were talking about the flooding of and release of water on the Colorado down where you are, doing major releases to help make the river more healthy and the, the structure in the river more healthy and wash out silt and stuff. That was a natural thing before we put in the dams. And that is one problem that the tailwaters have created is, but they're starting to work with us now on that, which is great. And like you said, the release that they just did was a major help, right, in your area?
Yes, yes. They've been doing this, they're called HFE, high flow experiments. And the basic idea of it is to try to mimic natural flood events that would occur on a river, basically a tailwater. You know, most of the tailwaters, the sediment is trapped back behind the reservoir, and in order to rebuild the beaches, they need to create a high flow event. And this has kind of been explored on the Colorado River. You know, I'm not going to tell you that I'm the greatest fan of this because, you know, there's a lot of controversy associated with trying to create natural flooding events with clear, cold water where, you know, there's not any sediment being transported from the reservoir where there's only sediment that is being literally moved below. So, you know, you have to take some of the sediment in order to redeposit it. Most of the sediment is actually transported. But this year, we had some major flash flooding events on the Colorado River right below Glen Canyon Dam that brought in just thousands of tons of sand, and it coated our bottom. It covered several miles of the river, and I felt this was probably unhealthy in the long term for the river. So this year, the flood event that just occurred here a couple of weeks ago moved a lot of that sand further downriver, deposited on the sides, and cleared out a lot of the spawning area and aquatic habitat for our aquatic insects and vegetation. So in the long term, I think it would be a really good thing for us. And, you know, I've heard the same thoughts over on the San Juan where they do some of the high flow events. It moves out some of the silt. So that can actually be beneficial if they're used judiciously.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, all these things, you know, we play around with Mother Nature, and then years later we find out we screwed up again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I guess we take our best shot as we go through life and
learn as we go.
We yeah. How big a dam do we have to have to get the tailwater effect? I mean, because we really have dams everywhere from just, you know, a diversion dam, which obviously isn't big enough, but there's all different sizes. Is there any kind of correlation between size and the tailwater effect?
Roger, no, there's not. I mean, for example, Lee's Ferry, let's talk in CFS, cubic feet per second. It's a number that a lot of people understand. Our river flows different flow regimens throughout the year, as do most tailwaters, because of hydroelectric demand, runoff releases, irrigation, all of these things come into play. But for example, our normal flows this time of year are about 10,000 cubic feet per second would be our minimum flow, up to 16,000 cubic feet per second. Then you might take a river like the Dolores in Colorado, which, you know, the cubic feet per second would be very, very low. So, no, there's not really any particular size of river that makes a tailwater. Also, elevation is going to have a lot of effect on that. Air temperatures, amount of sunlight, a lot of tailwaters are in canyons, so you get restriction to sunlight, especially in the wintertime when the sun's laying over to the south. There's just a huge variation and variety of tailwaters, flows, regimes. But, you know, the one thing that they do certainly have in common is they almost all produce terrific fishing 365 days a year. One of the beauties of tailwaters is they are not typically seasonally affected by muddy water or extreme runoff. So, you know, I know a lot of times, especially in Colorado, whenever you guys have a high runoff year, you know, all of a sudden the tailwaters are all busy because those are only the only fishable rivers in those regions.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. But it does have to have, we do have to have like a dam that has water deep enough to maintain a constant temperature, right? I mean, isn't that the key to these tailwaters?
Well, yes, but also you'd have to take into consideration at a higher elevation, you might have much cooler temperatures that would allow a tailwater of, you know, very shallow depth to still maintain those temperatures. And, you know, again, water volume is and velocity below the dam is a huge thing. A perfect example of that is, you know, there's many tailwaters like the San Juan that actually starts to warm fairly quickly after exiting the dam. Whereas, for example, Lee's Ferry in the Colorado River, our temperatures increase. If it's 110 degrees outside in the summertime, our water temperature will increase 1 degree for every 30 miles. So, 300 miles downriver at Lake Mead, you would have a 10 degree warming. And that's pretty amazing considering
wow.
the size
yeah.
of the river. And that's, again, due to the size, the volume, and velocity of water. So there's so many different scenarios, and it's very complicated.
Well, just like you said, you know, your average flow there is around 10,000 CFS. And I know up here on the upper Colorado and by State Bridge, if it's flowing 9 or 10 there, you know, we're talking about dangerous water up here because of the, you know, the size of the river, the same river up here, but in a different place and different structure and so forth, where 10,000 is a ton of water coming through. So,
right.
In fact, we can't, you know, we usually don't float it because that's, you know, down at 3,000 or 4,000 is more manageable. But, so yeah, that shows you how big the Colorado becomes down there.
Absolutely. And Roger's something really important here, you know, the book that Wendy and I have just finished, it's called The 50 Best Tailwaters to Fly Fish. And whenever Stonefly Press first approached me about writing this book, I thought to myself, you know, I have a hard enough time being an expert always on my own tailwater because tailwaters have changed constantly, the flows, the fish behavior, the seasons, everything. So we basically went out and I sought out the experts. I went out and found 56 experts, people that had actually worn out wading boots in the waters that they were going to be writing about. So, you know, I didn't write the entire book. We just basically got the people together, the best experts, and chose the 56 best tailwaters.
Mm-hmm. Great, great. And what, you know, what were some of the common threads you found after putting, you know, assembling all those experts? Is there anything that, you know, good, bad, or ugly?
You know, one of the things that really jumped out to me tonight, I was thumbing through in the back of the book, in the back of each chapter, at the end of each chapter, suggested flies, and I was just amazed at how often the beadhead zebra midge shows up as one of the selected flies on the tailwaters. And interestingly enough, that was a fly that was invented at Lee's Ferry.
All of the consistency is great fishing year-round. I think that's the single most important factor. And also, you know, tailwaters often allow great trout fishing in places that normally would not have great trout fishing. The southern part of the country, the Guadalupe River in southern Texas, down by San Antonio, is a great example, as is Lee's Ferry, you know, basically in a desert situation. So, you know, I would say that would be the most important common thread.
Yeah, okay. Brian Whiting from Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and Brian was a guest on our show a few years back. He wrote in, he says, congratulations on over 20 years of providing great family experiences at Lee's Ferry and on your new book. And he asks, how far downstream from the dam will a tailwater begin to fish more like a typical snowmelt river? not sure what he means exactly by a snowmelt river, but I think he's wanting to know, you know, when does the river change up to where it's really not much of a tailwater anymore and is more normal for the region, I suppose.
I remember the first time that Brian showed up at Lee's Ferry with his kids in tow. They were very, very young. I think one of them was still in a backpack, and that was over 20 years ago. It's been fun to watch these kids grow up and develop. Answer the question, it's kind of a complicated question, and I think, again, talking about generalities of various rivers, it's very hard to say because each river is going to be so completely different. The warming trend, you know, again, the Lee's Ferry so far downriver, I really don't know how to answer that, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, I know right there from where you're at, you go upriver to fish, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You head up to the dam. And right there from about Lee's Ferry, actually where the bridge crosses the river down, then I notice the river starts changing up rather quickly. And tell me if I'm wrong here, but I mean, when we put in there at the river, we could probably within the first few miles, we start seeing the coloration of the river change from a crystal clear water and start to cloud up and get more murky.
And that's because of the tributary, the Paria River, that comes in immediately below Lee's Ferry. And, of course, any side streams and tributaries can have a huge influence as far as sediment and also possibly changing the water temperature. You know, if it's a large enough volume of water coming in, it can certainly change the water temperature of the tailwater.
But isn't that one of the conditions that starts to knock the trout out, that sediment in most of these tailwaters? I mean, as it muddies up, the trout, it's not a place the trout like to live anymore, and we start switching over to other types of fish.
Well, you would think so. However, you know, on the Colorado River, they've done a tremendous amount of research down below Lee's Ferry in the reach of river that often becomes muddy. I mean, whenever we say muddy, it has absolutely zero visibility. You could step in the river and be ankle deep and not be able to see your wading boots. And
right. The
trout populations down there are pretty healthy. I think the single most important thing is the temperature. You know, that is the single most important thing related to tailwater fisheries because, you know, once the temperature increases too quickly, and I think it's more important on the upper end, you know, basically 60-something degrees for rainbow trout. Brown trout, of course, can tolerate warmer temperatures, but you know, if you have these side streams coming in, warming the water too much, or, you know, the slower water, lower volumes, becomes too warm for the trout, the fish can't live there.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember that's kind of the way the Green River is up there in Utah and northwestern Colorado, where, you know, it starts out really good rainbow water, starts changing to brown water, and then eventually it peters out because the water gets too warm. You start getting into open farmlands out of the canyons. Starts warming up.
And it becomes carp water there.
Right, exactly. Yep. So you just have to switch up.
Yep.
Go after the carp.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We need to take a quick break here, Terry. When we come back, we'll talk more about tailwaters. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Terry Gunn about tackling tailwaters. So if you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. But, Terry, at this point in the show, I always ask, you know, my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world. So tell us a bit about what's happening down there in Lee's Ferry and what you guys are up to.
Well, it's the time of year that we kind of slow down. I mean, like most places, however, the fish are still happy. This is the time of year that our rainbow trout actually start spawning, which is very unusual. Most rainbow trout being spring spawners. our rainbow trout actually begin spawning in December and continue all the way through June. So that's pretty much what's happening this time of year. The fish are starting to move into the shallows, and we're starting to see a lot more fish coloring up, getting that brilliant red sides, and getting ready for the spawn.
And tell us a bit about your business. And you already mentioned your book that is now out and available, right?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, it is just now shipping. We actually sold out of the first shipment, and the books are at the warehouse shipping right now. Amazon should have them in a few days. We have them at Least Very Angler's Fly Shop, stoneflypress.com, or any of your local fly shops. So if they're shipping, people should be having them in their shops. Make a great Christmas present for any fisherman. These books will.
Definitely, definitely. And what are the services you offer down there at Lee's Ferry?
We offer guide service at Lee's Ferry. We put in at Lee's Ferry and go 16 miles of river from Lee's Ferry to Glen Canyon Dam. I have 9 full-time fishing guides. They're all professionals, no part-timers. We're using power boats to access the river. They're 20-foot Koffler boats, jet drives, very comfortable boats. We have a full-service fly shop, a lodge, a restaurant, gas station, basically rental boats. Also, we have rental boats so that you could rent a boat and tow it to the river. They're power boats, 18-foot welded aluminum boats with 4-stroke jet drives on them, so you don't have to worry about knocking the prop off. Basically, all you need to do is show up at Lee's Ferry, and we can take care of all of your needs.
Terrific, terrific. And for those of you that want to learn more about fishing Lee's Ferry, check out our archive with the show we did with Wendy Gunn. And you can just search by Wendy Gunn and or Lee's Ferry, and you'll find that show. And that's where we talk specifically about those waters where Terry and Wendy call home. So, okay, let's see. Some of the other questions, and I think you kind of answered this, but one of the questions was, does tailwater fish any differently at different times of the year?
Absolutely. I mean, again, I'll use Lee's Ferry as a perfect example because, you know, the fish are getting ready to spawn. They're changing their position. In the springtime, we have major, major midge hatches, at which time the fish move into the extremely shallow ripples where the midge pupa are concentrated. Then later on, the fish are moving into the littoral areas of the river in July because of the cicada hatch. They're feeding on these big bugs as they hit the water. Then in the summertime, we have our highest flows, and these high-velocity flows stir up a lot of the large food items, like the scuds and the worms. The fish are feeding voraciously. The one thing, another common thread, is when there's the food in the water and the fish are eating, that's whenever you catch a lot of fish. The fish are happy when there's a lot of food in the water.
And I'll just throw these two questions, because there's two questions that have come in on the Internet here about your area specifically. But Phil in Murray, Utah, and Brian in Waterloo, Iowa, both ask, what are the best times of years to – what is the best time of year to fish in, down in Lee's Ferry in your area?
You know, whenever you have time, that's my most common response. My favorite time of year has always been the spring because of the sight casting to subsurface midging fish. Also, the summer. The summer fishing is so consistent. It is consistent day in and day out. It's very, very good. And that's because those high-velocity flows are stirring up the food. The fish are eating all of the time. The fall, we have beautiful, spectacular weather. The fishing is generally good. The winter, we still have people come and brave the winter temperatures, but the fish could be great in the winter as well. But my two favorite times are the spring and summer.
What's the temperature down there on the river now?
Oh, right now the temperatures, we're actually having a cold front move through and sub-freezing in the morning. I think it was like 31 degrees this morning, warming up into the 50s during the day, which is pretty typical. Weather starts warming usually. We consider spring to be about February 15th, continuing through June 1st. Then June 1st would be our summer temperatures, extremely hot, but so is the fishing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember when we floated, ran the Grand Canyon, you know, we did it in April, end of March and into the first part of April, and it was a beautiful time down in there because It was literally shorts and t-shirts in the canyon bottom, but you could see snow up on the rim. And that was a really cool thing. So it starts warming, those rocks start warming early in the spring, I guess, and make it for a nice spring weather down there. And you just mentioned a little bit about water releases. You know, we talked about the big releases, which, of course, are not a time to go fishing when there's 40,000 CFS running down the river. But, you know, these periodic releases, and I know that differs from one tailwater to another. I know it was down on the White River in Arkansas. They have major releases that you need to be concerned about for safety purposes. And I don't think you experience those kind of releases in Lee's Ferry, or do you? And how do they affect the fishing?
Well, historically, we did experience these huge fluctuations. Then back in the 80s, the late 80s, they came in and did an environmental impact study, and they concluded that these major fluctuations were actually not good for not only the trout, but the endangered species, beaches. They were having several negative impacts. So they now have limited the amount of ramp rate, which is the up and down rise, and also the minimum in-stream flow, which for us is 5,000 cubic feet per second. They cannot go below that. So, you know, various regimes definitely have different effects on the fish.
Yeah, I know, you know, the White River, and I think Davey Monten that I've interviewed a couple times, and he's got another show coming up here. You know, you talk about blasts from horns warning people downstream, you know. And I know a lot, I think that's kind of typical in a lot of tailwaters where you have to be careful about, you wade across the river and they start doing a release that you're not aware of, you may not be able to get back across the river the same day. So I've heard lots of stories about those kind of situations.
You know, Roger, there's an easy way to make sure that you stay safe in a rising water situation. There's the old story at Lee's Ferry that what you do is you just take a $50 bill and you place it on a rock right next to you, okay? Because I guarantee you, you're going to be keeping your eye on that $50 bill. and if it starts floating away, it's time for you to get out of the water.
To get out of there, yeah. So another question here, just how educated are these tailwater trout compared to trout in freestone rivers? Are they any smarter, or are they more difficult to catch?
I would say yes, and I think that a lot of this has to do with pressure. You know, a lot of your tailwaters get quite a lot of the pressure. I mean, for example, I've spent a lot of time up on the Taylor River, and, you know, a fish will see a split shot, and they'll run out of the way. One of my favorite memories is several years ago, I was over on the San Juan River, and we were filming a TV show for Flyfish TV, and we were using a strike indicator, and the guide was telling me, really keep an eye on that indicator, if it moves at all, to set the hook. And my indicator's drifting along, and the guide said, hit it. I looked over at him, and I said, hit what? And he said, you didn't see that indicator move? I said, no. He said, well, what happened was that fish actually took that midge in his mouth, realized it was a midge, and then spit it out. So, yeah, I think tailwater fish are typically more educated, more spooky, and it's more technical style of fishing.
Okay. Do you find larger fish closer to the dam, or are they situated throughout the tailwater?
I think that you would find if you walked into almost every tailwater fly shop and you looked at the big grip and grin shots up on the wall, you would be surprised at how many of those photographs actually have the dam in the background. I think that it holds true almost universally. I don't know whether it has to do with oxygenation of the water, the nutrient flow, colder water, maybe a combination of all of those factors. However, I think that you will almost always find the larger fish closer to the dam. One of the best examples, again, going back to the Taylor River, if you ever pull into that overlook and look down in the after bay right below the area, of course, that nobody can access, and see, that's
right.
That's another thing with a lot of these tailwaters. you're not going to be accessing right directly below the dam due to, you know, safety concerns as well as security concerns. And so, you know, these big trout, being the smart fish that they are, that's where they'll go hang out, where nobody messes with them.
Yeah, I remember that, Don the Taylor. All the fly fishers go up there and kind of look over the rail and say a few choice words about how they'd like to be fishing there right now. But
the biggest rainbow trout in the world swimming down below you there.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, see, that table water is a lot different. Taylor is a lot different because it's really pretty small stream coming out of the bottom of that. I mean, you can throw a rock across it real easy. So that those fish can really see you well there. And I know what you're talking about. Those are tough ones to hook into on a Taylor.
Very technical fishing.
Yeah. Another question was the differences between fishing a tailwater versus like Spring Creeks and Freestone Rivers. Is there a different approach you take? Do you see differences? Do you see a mix of those happening?
You know, a mix of those things happening. I think, again, let's talk about the technical aspects of a lot of the tailwaters. A lot of the tailwaters, we have to use finer tippets, longer leaders. You know, these are, if a fish sees a fly every single day, he's going to recognize that as being a fly after he eats it a certain number of times, because fish have the ability to remember. And I think that's one of the reasons that on so many of the tailwaters, we've had to go to smaller and smaller tippets and smaller flies. You know, it's real easy. A lot of times people ask me why we have to use such small flies. It's my opinion that a fish has a more difficult time discerning a natural from an artificial the smaller the fly goes. A perfect example of that is if you were to take a size 12 Adams fly and hold it in your hand, you'd look at it instantly and say, you know, it's a size 12 Adam. Whereas you take a size 24 Adams, put it in your hand, you might have to look at it to determine, is that a real insect or is that an artificial insect?
I can see your point there, yeah. Yeah, so, less selective when it gets small and things are moving fast under the water, too. You know,
yep,
that's
absolutely.
Speed, and that speed and size together create less recognition points,
absolutely.
I guess. Yeah. Before we start talking about food and flies more in depth here in presentation, we did have one question that came in from Chip in Louisville, and this kind of is something as fly fishers we might be concerned about across the United States or even the world. But he says he wants to know if there's any additional federal legislation that would negatively affect tailwater fishing. Evidently, down in Lake Cumberland area, the Army Corps of Engineers wanted to stop all the fishing in the tailwater area, and I guess they announced that, and then it got overturned. But do you know anything about that or another in your area? I'm sure you're always on top of what's happening, those kind of things, because it affects your business.
I really appreciate this question from Chip. This was a really big deal down on the Cumberland. The Army Corps of Engineers basically announced that because of safety concerns, they were going to close the tailwaters on the Cumberland, several different tailwaters, to fishing from boats. They would still allow people to wade from the shore, but they were going to stop all boats, powered drift boats, basically because of what they called a safety concern. And the Cumberland River was one of the tailwaters we cover in our book, and so, you know, this was a real big deal because as this book was basically being put together, this question was in focus, and we were not sure we were even going to be able to continue to cover the Cumberland or radically alter the chapter because of it. But common sense prevailed for a change, and the tailwater is being kept open. There are lots of other factors that could affect us. Endangered species, I think that's the big one. You know, in the West, we have lots of endangered species, and now there is a big push by lots of organizations to try to return all native species. And many of the fish that we fish for in tailwaters are not native species. The rainbow trout, brown trout, brook trout, a lot of these are exotic species that have been introduced that thrive in tailwaters. And so, you know, all of these things are very, very important considerations, and something as anglers we have to be very involved in to protect our right to fish.
Right, yeah. And also, as we were talking before the show, too, decommissioning of dams will have its effect, too. Some of those things are good, I think. In fact, some of the dams cause the adverse effect, you know, when you've got salmon runs and steelhead runs that are...
Absolutely.
You know,
there's a lot of dams that need to go away, no question about it. But, you know, also at the same time, sometimes tailwater dams get painted with that same brush, you know.
Right.
I mean, not all dams are bad. Not all dams are good. You know, there are pushes by many environmental organizations to take out Glen Canyon Dam, to take out Flaming Gorge. You know, they want to see these rivers restored. But, you know, these are the lifeblood of the West, protecting water so that, you know, municipal towns and cities have water and irrigation and everything else. So,
yeah, and it, you know, the world changes too. You know, when Colorado flowed free and wild, you know, all there were Indians out here. You know, and you didn't have, you know, millions of people in L.A. and Las Vegas wanting some water. So,
but today, the population of Las Vegas in 1910 was 30 people.
30 people, yeah. And
that's
in
perfect example.
Yeah, and in 1800, it was probably zero.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, maybe there was an Indian tribe there, and, you know, with a few hundred people maybe, but yeah, times change. Anyway, we need to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about some flies and some presentation techniques that you guys are using in the tailwater. So we'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the more informational and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Terry Gunn about tackling tailwaters. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, talking about flies, food, flies, rigging, that kind of thing, one of the questions came in is, are there any big bugs or large food forms available, or is it mostly small-sized insects? And do you have to use long leaders and fine tippets when we're talking about tailwaters?
At least, Gary, we're unusual because basically we don't have the normal insect hatches. Our bugs are midges. We have 40, 50 different species of midges from size. A big one for us is a size 16 down to the ones that you can't hardly even see, you know, size 30s. However, that changes in the summertime because we have a tremendous cicada hatch, as does the Green River.
Right.
These are not your normal cicadas. They are not periodic cicadas that only occur every 7 or 14 years. The type of cicadas that occur, at least vary and on the grain, are annual cicadas. So you can count on them every single year. Some years they're massive hatches. Some years they're just mediocre. Another thing that comes to mind real quick as far as big bugs is the Black Canyon of the Gunnison, which the salmon fly hatch. I mean, these bugs hit you in the forehead and they hurt. They're amazing. But, you know, every river, again, is different. You're going to find that a lot of the rivers have larger insect hatches, not just midges. Of course, you know, midges are real important in the wintertime whenever a lot of these larger insects aren't hatching.
Yeah, so no stoneflies down where you're at, or?
We have, absolutely. Basically what happened, at least very, all of the insects prior to the dam that lived in that river were basically extirpated whenever Glen Canyon Dam, the gates closed. They weren't the type of insect that could evolve into our colder water. And what makes our location so interesting, we're in the middle of the desert. I mean, our closest other naturally occurring cold water insect is probably Colorado. So, you know, and they're not going to fly over, so unless they're actually reintroduced, which we're working on people now, that idea of the reintroduction of some of the insects in our tailwater, they will not ever naturally find their way there.
Yeah, because they'd have to go through the dam and all that.
They would have to fly several hundred miles. And, you know, the prevailing winds are going to come from the west, and they're going to be flying with a head.
Yeah. You never know, though.
Okay.
I've heard stories out out in the Pacific Ocean where there's this island, you know, and there's animals on it that there's no rhyme or reason how they got there, but they floated on a log or something, you know, and somehow got
held
there.
Held on to a coconut.
So don't say never. It could happen. Okay, so you're dealing with a lot of small flies on most of the tailwaters, a lot of midges. You're not an exception in that regard down there. But so what kind of, you know, how do you rig up your leader and tippet and your terminal tackle to pull the fish?
You know, basically, at Lee's Ferry, I have three different rigs. I have what is called a heavy nymph rig. We're almost always using, unless we're streamer fishing, okay, which is a different topic, we use a floating line. And our fly line color is really important at Lee's Ferry. You've got to use a muted color fly line. Bright fluorescent oranges and yellows will spook the fish, not only on the water, but also in the air. Our water is so clear that the fish will actually spook off bright colored fly lines. So I like a blue, a green, you know, any color that basically occurs in nature. Light brown, tan, that all works good. A long leader. Depending on the type of water we're fishing, our leaders will be a minimum usually of 9 feet up to as long as 16 feet long. In the summertime, fishing a heavy nymph rig, I'll have a strike indicator that will be up near the fly line, and that would be either a yarn indicator or a thingamabobber. I'll have a 9-foot 4X leader. I'll tie a section of 5X to that to get it longer than a split shot. Then from my split shot to my point fly, which would always be your largest fly, that's 18 inches, and then another 18 inches below that with either 5 or 6X tippet. We can rarely go any heavier than 6X tippet. Then my other rig is a double tiny rig, which is fishing two midges, two very small midges, you know, 18 to size 20 midges, basically, 9-foot leader. A yarn strike indicator, I prefer not to use a thingamabobber for that. Again, the strike indicator that I like to use is yarn, and it would be a color, a white, green, or blue, something that's muted. Bright fluorescent strike indicators, red and oranges can spook our fish, especially if you're fishing in shallower water. Again, 9-foot long, the leader, the strike indicator would be 2 to 9 feet above the micro shot, so I'm going 5X to a 6X tippet, or even sometimes we use 7X tippet, the two flies separated by 18 inches. Then my favorite rig, and I think almost everybody's favorite rig to fish, is a dry and a dropper. The large dry fly acts as a strike indicator, also it is a fly that the fish might eat. Royal Wolf works great for us in a size 16 to a 14, then tip it tight up off the end of the shank of the hook, varying depths of water, varying lengths of tippet there. It would be the shortest I would use would probably be about a 6 inch to a foot, as long as 4 feet below that with a weighted nymph, a beadhead nymph.
Okay. That was Gene in Camas, Washington, just wrote in on the internet, and he says, when and why do you decide to use more than one fly, and how do you decide which goes on top and which goes on the bottom?
That's a great question, and I always use two flies. I look at two flies as acting as a team. I can't tell you how many times over the years I've been fishing with a client, and they don't like fishing two flies, and maybe they might break off one of the flies. Let's say, for example, we're fishing a scud with a midge below it. All of the fish have been eating the midge, so they decide only to put a midge on while I'm helping another customer, and all of a sudden they stop catching fish, and I come back, and I say, what's happened? And it's, well, I just went to this one fly, because that's the one that we were catching all the fish on. There's something about two flies having an effect on each other, okay? And I can't explain it, but given the we always fish basically two flies. It's extremely rare that we fish a single fly. In Arizona, we're limited to two flies. Some states, you can actually fish three. In Great Britain, they call that a brace of flies. And which fly goes where? My large fly, if I'm fishing two nymphs, always goes on the top, the small fly on the bottom.
Okay. And I've heard that before from other guests about the multi-fly rig, about the idea of, you know, two flies in the water. You know, some have said, well, you know, it could be an attractor. You know, it could be an activate the fish's senses, like they're seeing a couple of bugs coming down the water and they grab one. Whereas if there's only one bug coming down, then it's not as apparent or attractive to them. Like you say, who really knows, huh? But the end result is that after years of experience, that's the way it is, right?
That's the way it is. There is synergy there that I cannot explain to you. There's a lot about trout behavior that I can't explain to you. All I can say is I know it works.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of like the trout learn, we learn.
Yep, absolutely.
After so many times, you realize what works and keep doing it. Now, I think I pretty much know what this answer is going to be, but we'll ask the question anyway. Brian Adams in Bakersfield, California, says, if you could choose one fly for all these tailwaters, what would it be? And he says, it would probably be a midge on your home water, and I think he'd be right.
He's 100% right. On my home water, if I had one fly, it would be a beadhead zebra midge, black and silver, and a size 16. If I were to take one fly on all of the tailwaters, it would probably be a woolly booger and as a streamer. If I couldn't fish a woolly booger for some reason and I had to fish a nymph, it would be a pheasant tail nymph on all the tailwaters.
Okay. And let's see here. Oh, on the internet, Larry Hull wrote in, and this is kind of a good transition. He says, don't close the show without having Terry talk about streamer fishing on tailwaters. When, how, patterns. Thanks, Larry. So, you want to talk a bit about streamers?
You know, let me talk about the streamer fishing that I really know about. That is at Lee's Ferry. And for many years, I didn't fish the streamer. I don't know why. I just kind of disdained streamer fishing. A few years ago, I really started getting into the streamer fishing, and I have discovered a lot. One, a lot of my customers really love the streamer fishing. There's nothing quite like the of a fish on a streamer. And it's very, very productive. Whenever I find the streamer fishing at Lee's Ferry to be most productive is in higher water, whenever the food is being moved around. Now, you know, streamers take on a lot of personalities, or people try to say, well, it's imitating a bait fish. I think if you look at a woolly bugger, even rainbow trout, which are normally not very vociferous, they're not going to eat minnows or other fish, but they're going to readily take a woolly bugger. You look at a woolly bugger in the water, it looks like food, it moves like food. By golly, it must be food. And I think that's the reason that they're so effective in so many tailwaters.
Okay, good. Well, let's take another quick break here, and then we'll talk more about presentation techniques and so forth. In regards to the tailwater, so we'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Terry Gunn about tackling tailwaters. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight. Okay, one of the questions that came in, moving on to some presentation aspects here, is what do you look for when fishing a tailwater for the first time?
What I look for fishing a tailwater for the very first time is the closest local fly shop. That's where you're going to find out everything that you need to know about being successful on that body of water. And, you know, I want to mention right now, we talked about endangered species. Your local fly shop is one of the most endangered species out there these days, folks. And I'll tell you, we've all got to go out of our way to support these people, because as we see these fly shops closing, we are losing our local mentors and experts on that water. So go out of your way to keep these fly shops in business. And I can't give you any other better advice for the first thing to do. Look for that local fly shop.
But, Terry, every time I do that, how come they always have, they always are recommending all the flies that I don't have in my boxes?
isn't that ironic? And I mean, that's the reason to go there, is to find out that your local flies aren't going to be working.
Yeah. I think there's a mass conspiracy there, you know, between fly shops and guides and everything. You know,
it's the trout. We have nothing to do with it.
You mean you don't see us coming and they say, oh yeah, there's a guy from Colorado. Switch up the boxes now. We're going to sell him this other selection. Doesn't work that way, huh?
Doesn't work that way.
Okay. All right. I thought there was a conspiracy going on, but I guess not. So, what do you think the biggest challenge for fly fishers is with tailwaters?
Being safe. Tailwaters, as we talked about earlier, offer fluctuating water flows. You know, so many of us go to or are accustomed to rivers that, you know, do not change. For it to change an inch in any given day is unheard of. Whereas in a tailwater, you know, the White, Lease Ferry, and many, many tailwaters, these waters can fluctuate several feet in any day. So I think that is your biggest challenge. Be aware of your conditions. Pay attention to what the locals say as far as, you know, flows, flow regimes. Also, another thing about being safe in tailwaters is don't wade too deeply. Never put yourself in a dangerous situation, because one consistent thing we've already talked about, tailwaters, this extremely cold water, like at Lee's Ferry, 48-degree water. You fall in that water, you don't last very long. So, you know, always pay very close attention to conditions, water flows, and keep yourself safe. And if you're boating on one of these tailwaters, you know, at Lee's Ferry, we're using power boats, and people knock their props off all the time because of obstacles and, you know, some of the smaller rivers, drift boats, hitting and getting grounded. You know, if the locals say, don't put your boat in here today, it's not safe, don't do it. Trust them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's all kinds of stories about, I know with my drift boat, I had a friend of my father's with us one time, and he stood up just as we were kind of pulling in to anchor on the side. And so the boat ran up on, you know, a little gravel bed there, and of course he stood up right about the time that I was putting the boat in there, and guess what? You know, the jolt put him over the side of the boat and into the water. You know, it was only like 3 inches of water, but, you know, he could have really gotten hurt, you know, and paying attention to what's going on and, you know, especially not standing up in the boat and stuff like when you're pulling the boat in, stuff you need to watch out for. But what about the other challenges on a fly fishing level? Okay, safety in check,
you know,
there. What,
I think, what, too, a lot of people go to streams unprepared. As we mentioned earlier, I've been guiding 30 years. I probably have 6,000 days on the river, not only at Lee's Ferry, but other places guiding fishermen. And one thing that I see a lot of times, people come fishing once a year, and they don't practice their cast before they come. They don't really study about what they need to be doing. You know, before you go on one of these trips, go out in the backyard, spend a little bit of time just practicing your cast. You don't have to have water to do that. You'll enjoy your experience a great deal more if you put a little bit of time preparing for the trip before you get there.
Yeah, and I know, you know, one thing I did before I went down for tarpon in Key West is took some casting lessons.
Yep,
and,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, I've been fishing all my life, but I said, you know what, I'm not familiar with fishing salt water. I need, you know, I need some help with this. And, you know, that was some of the best few hours and best money I had spent on fly fishing in a long time, because the And there was a difference. I did experience one instructor that was not very good, even though he was certified. But my second instructor helped me tremendously, tremendously. And it wasn't just for saltwater. I mean, it was for freshwater, whatever. I learned so much in those few hours. It was well worth the money. So anytime I talk to people, I say, hey, go take a few casting lessons. You'll be surprised what you'll learn from somebody that does this every day, that, the bad habits you have and the new techniques that you can learn that you don't even know about. So,
great advice indeed.
Yeah, yeah. And we always think, you get in a rut with anything, whether it's golf or fly fishing or whatever. Sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees, so I that's always my recommendation. Do you do more sight fishing in tailwaters, or do you find you do more blind casting?
Given the opportunity, I will always sight cast. And one of the beauties of tailwaters, again, is our consistently clear water. Now, every river's different. I mean, for example, the San Juan, you can't do a lot of sight casting because the water's a little darker. But given the opportunity to sight cast over blind cast, I can tell you right now that almost everyone would much prefer to sight cast. I think that's one of the reasons that people enjoy dry fly fishing so much more the nymph fishing, because essentially you're casting to a known target. You're casting to a fish that is in fact feeding and rising. And I love to sight cast. Given the opportunity, I'll do that all day long.
And that's where you'll move your clients to when you're taking them out? If the conditions are right, you move towards sight casting?
Yeah, but it's always fun for a guide to show his clients the fish, talk about the presentation, what you need to do to catch that fish, and then actually having the fish eat the fly. I mean, that's very rewarding for the guide and also the angler. The only time that this sight casting will jump up and bite you is whenever you've got 100 fish out in front of you, and it's one of those days those fish are not eating, and your client might get a little disappointed because he sees all these fish, yet he can't get them to eat.
Yeah, yeah. But nobody's going to get them to eat on that day, right?
Absolutely, and there are those days. I mean, no matter where you are, how well you plan your trip, there are some days that the fish just don't want to eat.
What about finding the larger fish? When you're out there trying to find a trophy fish, where do you go? What do you look for? And does your presentation change up for these fish as opposed to other fish?
Well, first of all, you go up close to the dam where all those
go up close to the dam at night with a flashlight, right?
Right. Yeah, there's a reason fish are big. Always keep that in mind. And I think that bigger fish are definitely going to be a little more wary. I mean, they've survived for a longer period of time. They've had more experiences, more education. Probably, that longer leader. Maybe that finer tippet. Sometimes, changing the flies. First of all, locating the fish. And that's where you spend the time on the river. And, maybe you've been in a certain spot and broken a fish off, in times past. And one interesting thing that this kind of leads into is, it's been my experience that once you find a fish in a specific area, they really don't move very far. That's home for them. I mean, I can tell you fish that I've gotten to know over the years because of, body coloration, or one fish that I used to know, we named him Blackie because half of his head was black. You could go to the same exact spot every single day, and that fish would be within 15 or 20 feet of where you saw him the day before. So, big fish are creatures of habit, and, you find them, you can come back and catch them another day.
And what about your presentation? Do you find you fish differently for larger fish?
Well, again, you've got to be smarter than the fish, and that might mean, a more delicate presentation, keeping that fly line, thinking about the shadow. Think about the angle of the sun. Whenever your fly line is in the air, are you going to be casting a shadow over that fish? Yeah, the shadows will spook fish. Not only that, but even the leader and the tippet on the water can create a shadow. So, one of the most important things I always suggest to people before you even step into the water, try to take all of these things into consideration. Look at the sun. Think about the shadow. Think about the shadow from the cast of even the fly rod. And try to make that first cast your best cast. I can't tell you how many times over the years I've seen that first cast. If you blow it, you blow the fish. And think in terms of casting too long, okay? If you can cast short of the fish many times and possibly not spook that fish. However, that one cast on top of the fish or an area where he could see the fly actually land might spook the fish. One important thing that I see, at least because of our really clear water, is a shadow spooking the fish. And you think about the shadow of why a fish might be afraid of a shadow, whereas most of their enemies, most of their predators come from the air. The eagles, the cormorants, the mergansers actually come at the fish from above. So they're really spooky and conscious of shadows.
Yeah, and I think what the tip you just gave is a super tip about, you know, before you even go into the water, even probably best to be back 10, 20 feet from the water, is to take it all in and try to figure out, you know, where you're, like you said, the sunlight, where is it coming from, how is your shadow casting, what does your body look like in comparison to what's around you, you know, your surroundings. And I can't remember who I interviewed not too long ago, and we were talking about, you know, your position. Like, your position to get that fly to the fish may be much different than you might originally think. In other words, you know, so many people wade into the water and start just fishing, you know. Well, the best position might be upstream, you know, 20 feet and letting that fly go down, or the position might be downstream 20 feet, fishing back up with a hook cast or something like that. So I think, you know, that's super important that a lot of us don't really think too much about. You know, we're all so anxious to jump in there and, you know, start waving the rod around and not really considering all those things.
The most common mistake I see, at least very, is people wading into the water that they should actually be fishing. They have their mindset where they should be fishing, and they go right straight there instead of fishing from basically the shore and all of that water in between the area that they want to fish. And that's usually where the fish are.
Do you find you're fishing, you know, I don't know, maybe Lee's Ferry is, I've never fished Lee's Ferry, first of all, so I'm not familiar with it, but do you find you do more fishing there from the boat or wading?
It depends entirely on the time of year and the conditions that we have. In high water conditions, we are mostly fishing from the boat because a lot of the wading spots are actually, and the ripples are washed out in higher flows. So in the summertime, for example, most all of our fishing is done out of the boat, whereas the spring and the fall and most of the winter, the flows are much lower. And they are ideal wading flows. Given the opportunity, I find most people really enjoy wading. It gives you a more one-on-one experience with the fish, lets you slow down a little bit. On the other side of that, people that have physical limitations or people as they get older that are not comfortable with wading will prefer to fish from the boat. And, you know, Lee's Ferry is wonderful because we have the option to do both in every situation, any day. So, but again, most people, I think, prefer to wade.
Okay. We're winding down here to our last 5 minutes. I do have some questions, more specific questions about Lee's Ferry. We have some on the Internet here. Let me see if I can knock some of these off here quickly with you, Terry. Phil in California, Kentucky. There was a California. Maybe he lives both in California and Kentucky. He says, does streamer fishing produce bigger trout for you than the other flies?
I would say, generally speaking, yes, in most tailwaters.
Okay. Not counting Phil in Murray, Utah. Phil's here tonight. Not counting your river, what would be the next most fun place to go? And I'm assuming he's talking about tailwaters.
You know, that was one of the really neat things about doing this book, The 50 Best Tailwaters to Fly Fish, was the opportunity to to learn about some tailwaters that I did not necessarily know about. And let me tell you, there's a whole bunch of them out there that are basically under the radar. I mean, a whole bunch that I was totally unaware of back east especially. And, you know, the one that really comes to mind to me is the Owyhee River right outside of Boise, Idaho, that Wendy and I are going to go fish. That's the next one on our list.
Ah, okay. Okay, I'm not familiar with that one either, so that's a new one, yeah, to me.
No.
Let's see. Another Robin Bloomington, he says, I've been trying to get out to Lee's Ferry from Bloomington, Indiana. When's the best time that gives me a chance to meet Terry and Wendy?
The best time to meet Terry and Wendy is in the springtime, whenever everything is real busy and we're around. So, again, that is also one of my very favorite times. If I were to pick one time, I would probably say early May, the weather comes together, the fishing, the water conditions, that would be a great time to come to Lee's Ferry and meet Terry and Wendy.
Okay. Gary in Little Rock asks a couple of questions here online. Do you have sculpin and crayfish in your water, and if so, do you fish flies that imitate them?
We do not have sculpin or crayfish at Lee's Ferry. You know, a lot of tailwaters have sculpin and crayfish. One that comes to mind is the Wind River up in Wyoming again, which that's a sleeper, I'll tell you. If you ever have an opportunity, go up and fish the Wind. It is phenomenal. And lots of crayfish, and the fish get really big eating crayfish.
And Gary also asked, do you fish terrestrials?
One of the fascinating things about Lee's Ferry is we get terrestrials. We get a lot of grasshoppers, but it's the only place in the world I've ever seen where you can take a grasshopper, throw it in the water, and watch it float out of sight without a fish eating it. And I attribute that to the fact that our water is so big that the grasshoppers rarely have an opportunity to get in the water, and the fish just don't know what they are. The same thing happens with our cicada hatch, which usually begins around the 1st of July. I mean, the cicadas are singing, the population grows. It takes a week or so before the cicadas really start getting into the water, before the fish recognize what they are. Once they recognize what they are, the cicada hitting the water, even flying above the surface of the water, is fair game, and the fish will jump out of the water and try to grab them.
Yeah, and I've heard just the reverse of that, too, is that after, like, the cicada hatch is finished, that the fish will still be keyed on them for another week or something, because it's just the reverse of getting keyed up, that takes them a while to get keyed down, I guess.
That's absolutely right, and I've actually seen our fish key on them for up to a month or 2 months after we see any of the hatch.
Oh, wow. Let's see. Specific to your area, George in Boise was asking about periodic river flushing. I think we covered all that. Loretta Strickland in Oakland, California, she says, I've fished Lee's Ferry before with a guide. Is there ability to fish from the shore? We just talked about that, too, depending on time of year, right?
Actually, no, we didn't discuss that, because most of Lee's Ferry, you actually need a boat to access the 16-mile stretch of Lee's Ferry to Glen Canyon Dam. There is a mile-and-a-half stretch of river right at Lee's Ferry that you can drive up to. You do not need a boat. It's called the walk-in area. That fish is very, very good. You don't need a guide. Of course, you stop by the fly shop and get all the information, and we'll tell you which flies you have that won't work, and we'll get you all dialed in.
Okay, so, but once you're upriver, there are plenty of places you can wade given the time of year, but you need a boat to access, is what you're saying.
Absolutely,
right?
That is correct.
Yeah, yeah, okay, gotcha. Josh in Kiwi Valley, Kentucky, says, I've been to Lee's Ferry, found few, if any, insect activity since most of the food that trout eat is below the surface. Have you any recommendations for effective multiple nymph options? So he must be looking for, you know, bigger hatches than he might be getting down in Kentucky. You want to address that?
You know, again, if I were basically fishing a double tiny rig, which would be two beadhead midges, maybe a size 18, black and silver, as my point fly on top, and then maybe a size 20, different color, sometimes even the same color as the bottom fly, or a San Juan worm, and a scud would be my other choice on the heavy nymph rig.
Yeah, there's a lot of scud or shrimp that live in tailwaters, I've found. You know, in Colorado, a couple of places, the micey shrimp abound, and then I know scuds in Bighorn and scuds down on San Juan as well.
Very common in a lot of the tailwaters are the scuds. And the Miocene shrimp, some of your greatest tailwaters, it's a result of the Miocene shrimp. Taylor Reservoir being a great example, the Miocene live in the reservoir. And also the Frying Pan, another great example of the Miocene River. And the Miocene are transported from the reservoir into the river below, and the fish gorge on these things and grow to immense proportions.
Yeah, exactly. And one last comment and question is Horace in San Diego, and I guess he lives also in Brandon, Oregon. He says, is Wendy still tying those great flies? I think I still have some left over from about 20 years ago.
Those things are probably collector's editions by now. But in answer to your question, Wendy just drove over. We're at our second home in Kanab, Utah, and she just drove over today, and I helped her unload the car. And right on top of everything was her old Regal Vice. So, yep, she's still fine.
She still ties. Okay, good. Well, we've got to wrap things up here. We had a lot of great questions and interaction tonight. I always appreciate that. But we've got a few more minutes to go. We're going to be giving away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, the one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And, of course, we'll be giving away a DVD from Fly Fish TV. So, stick with us here a few more minutes, and maybe you'll win one of these great prizes. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization that uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's FamilyTies, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes here. Now, if you're one of the winners of the drawings, you're going to be randomly selected from our show's registration database. You didn't register yet. It's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so you have a chance to win one of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your prize. So first of all, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to www.fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And you can learn a lot more about the Federation, and it's a great, great organization to be a part of. Let's see here. Fire up my computer here. And our first winner for that is Larry Kudrick in Arkansas. So Larry Kudrick, Arkansas. Jot that down. Congratulations, Larry. I know you'll enjoy that membership to the Federation. And for those of you that didn't win, go check it out. See if it might be something that you want to join. Now, our second giveaway is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at AmatoBooks.com. And Amato publishes periodicals as well as many fine books, and I encourage you to go there as well and explore what they have. And our winner there is Phil McCartney in Kentucky. So congratulations, Phil, on that one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Okay, now, we're going to give away a DVD from Fly Fish TV. So Fly Fish TV has a lot of educational DVDs. We've mentioned a few from that Terry and Wendy were involved in, but they have many others. And if you're the winner tonight, give you your choice of one of those DVDs. You can surely pick Terry's or Wendy's, or take a look at all the other ones that they have out there at flyfishtv.com. So let's see here. I've got to clear my queue here. And our question, Terry, you're going to help me make sure we get the right answer to this. And I'll tell you what they think I'm going to ask. They're going to think I'm going to ask about the bead-headed zebra midge, but I'm not. So there. But Terry said, early on, he said there was, you know, we had asked about what's consistent throughout the different tailwaters. And he said there was one thing that was consistent about all the tailwaters after doing the book and so forth. What was that one thing that's consistent among all Larry's listening, so he knows he won here. Good. What's the one thing that's consistent between all the tailwaters that Terry mentioned? Let's see what, if anybody was paying attention. Dean. Now, let's see if he got this right. His answer is they fish year-round.
I think he got it right.
You think he got it right? You know what? He got it right the last show he was on, too. So.
Somebody was paying close attention. Well done.
Yeah, Dean's a good listener. Good listener. So, Dean, you won again. What can I say, buddy? Congratulations. And why don't you, you kind of know the routine, but I don't save your address and stuff, so send me your address again. And also, go out to Flyfish TV, explore around there, tell me which video you would like or DVD you would like, and then let me know about that, too, when you send me your address. And then we'll get you taken care of, Gene, over at flyfishtv.com. We'll get that shipped out to you directly and take care of you. So thanks again for Flyfish TV providing that great prize tonight, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. Terry, I appreciate you being on the show with us tonight. It was a great pleasure to talk with you. Enjoyed it and learned more about tailwaters. I always learn something on these. Amazing how much. I probably forgot more than, you know, after so many interviews, but it was a great pleasure talking to you. And thanks for being on the show.
Where did that hour and a half go, Roger?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, we were
Thank
just getting you. Fired up, weren't we? Yeah.
Yeah.
The way it is.
Thank you very, very much. A great honor being here, and hope to talk to you again one of these days.
Okay, sounds good. Well, hopefully everyone's found our archive on the website. If you haven't, there's a couple of links to it on our homepage and links at the bottom of every page. Dig into the archive. We've got over 180 shows there right now, and you can search by keyword or keyword phrase, like trout, tarpon, Madison River, Lee's Ferry, Wendy Gunn, Terry Gunn, and you're going to find all kinds of great shows there. Be sure to listen to the one that Wendy, the show I did with Wendy, especially if you're interested in Lee's Ferry. Great show we did there. Our next broadcast will be next year. We're going to skip over the second one in December, give everything a break during the holiday season here, but it's going to be on January 8th. First Wednesday actually falls on the on New Year's Day, so we're going to do it January 8th. We're still finalizing who we're going to have on that show. So watch the emails, and I'll let you know who our special guest will be for that show. But we've got a couple of people I'm talking to right now. We just haven't nailed it down. So we'll let you know. I want to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Flyfish TV, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, Power Fiber Magazine, online magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.